From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week in Inside Higher Ed. On February 25th, thousands of part-time professors participated in a National Day Without Adjuncts. We'll discuss what happens in the days and weeks that follow. And in Oklahoma, the new AP history exam has become political as conversations about the new exam have moved from high school corridors and college campuses to the state capitol. Hi, this is Casey Green. I'm the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. So welcome all. Ahead of our conversation, please note that you can post your thoughts about these discussions on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. We begin our conversation today talking about a day without adjuncts. What began as a speculative question in the blog post of an anonymous adjunct from San Jose State University last fall has become a national movement. What if adjuncts at colleges across the country took the day off, a day without adjuncts? Part-time faculty now comprise about half the working professoriate in the United States, so a day without adjuncts should, in theory, have had a significant impact on students and institutions. And the initial reports on the February 25th Day Without Adjuncts effort suggest that adjuncts at many campuses across the country participated by taking a day off and also by participating in campus rallies and teach-ins. Yet many adjuncts concerned about job security also worked on February 25th as if it were just another day in academe. The real question is, what happens next? Will the activities up to and on February 25th really help address the issues of most concern to part-time faculty? Compensation, benefits, job security, career path, and the respect of campus administrators and full-time tenure-track faculty. Joining us for this conversation are Roland Green, a professor of English at Stanford University and president of the Modern Language Association for 2015-16. Maria Maisto is president of the New Faculty Majority and an adjunct professor at Cuyahoga Community College in Cleveland, Ohio. And Scott Jasek, the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Scott Jasek at Inside Higher Ed, let me turn to you first in terms of mapping the terrain. What actually happened this week on February 25th? How widespread was the day without adjuncts?
I think it was pretty widespread, but not as a strike per se. There were certainly campuses where adjuncts did walk out, but the far greater impact, I would say, was the number of campuses that had rallies, events, where all of a sudden it became a focus of discussion. And I noticed in the days leading up to it, I saw in newspapers in metro areas that wouldn't normally be writing about adjunct working conditions were writing about adjunct working conditions. In our reporting on the day, we were quoting students who had never thought about this before now thinking about it. So from a broad perspective, I think it had a lot of participation. It captured discussion in academe and some attention outside of academe.
Maria Maisto, president of the New Faculty Majority, what's your take on the events leading up to, on, and after February 25th and the Day Without Adjuncts?
Well, what's really been interesting about the walkout is that it really reflects many of the tensions, strengths, evolution, and the potential of the movement. So what we saw, and I would disagree with Scott a little bit about this being the first time that this has really happened and taken hold, because we've had Campus Equity Week events dating back to the early 2000s. But I think what really made this event different was that it was called a walkout. I think that's what captured the media's attention. So that's, I think, what generated a lot of the interest, in addition to the ongoing organizing that has been happening. And so what we saw was, I think, at the very beginning of the walkout planning was definitely a grassroots call, but then once unions and organizations started to get involved, then it really kind of picked up steam, took off, got a little bit more organized. So it really reflects what can happen when people work together locally, but also with organizations and unions to make something really effective.
Roland Green, at Stanford, I'm guessing there's not a lot of adjuncts as we would find at other types of institutions, but from the perspective of humanists, certainly adjuncts carry a heavy load in terms of lower division curriculum, instructional responsibilities at many institutions. What's your take on the events leading up to and on February 25th?
Well, the MLA strongly support the goals behind the event, and we launched, in the days leading up to it, we launched a coordinated effort with our own Committee on Contingent Labor in the Profession called Action for Allies. The website is actionforallies.commons.mla.org, in which we reached out directly to tenure line faculty to support this initiative and to start having conversations on their campuses and issuing reports back to our initiative about what we can do concretely in each of our particular locations to support this effort. We got over 700 people joining us as allies, and now we are starting the process of collating their responses and presenting back to them action plans based on their information. So from our point of view, in terms of not just a one-day event, but the beginning of an ongoing conversation, we thought it was a tremendous success.
Right.
Maria Maestro, let me come back to you, building on Roland's comments. Talk about the day after and the weeks after. I mean, does this provide some initiative and momentum for the efforts nationwide and on individual campuses, or where does this go?
Yeah, I think absolutely. It tells folks in organizations like the MLA and NFM and in the unions that there's a real hunger for continuing action, for increasing action, and so that gives us our marching orders that we have to step up our efforts. Everyone has to step up our efforts, and we're certainly doing that on many different fronts, not only in terms of organizing on the ground, helping both in union contexts and in non-union contexts, but also supporting things that disciplinary organizations like the MLA is doing, reaching out to legislators, policymakers, students, parents, and the public. So it's definitely given us the impetus to move forward. We're going to keep working, and what we hope is that we'll have perhaps more conversation, more collaboration among groups that sometimes can ignore each other or shut each other out. And what we really need is unity and solidarity going forward within higher education and outside of higher education with other worker movements as well.
So along the lines of worker movements, Scott Jasek from Inside Higher Ed, the reporting this week talked about, cited a number of campuses where these conversations are going on, that they may have been lying fallow for a long time, where administrators and adjuncts are now more engaged in a conversation about issues of concern to adjuncts. Well, I think it's fair to say we've seen a similar set of activities in the wake of last December's National Labor Board decision about unionization at private institutions. How much of this is symbolic and how much of it is substantive?
Well, the union votes are very substantive. They will be, engaged in collective bargaining if they win the votes. And we just, another college just this week voted, their adjuncts voted to unionize. That is very substantive. And to the extent that people are getting political attention, that can be very substantive if there are funds provided for better wages, more benefits. I'm also struck by the campuses without union activity, where by some sort of coincidence this week, we saw several provosts or academic administrators holding open forums for adjuncts to talk. Now, granted, they might have done that without this event, and they may or may not do any follow-up, but there is an appreciation, I think, has been elevated. Now, over the long run, turning contracts into actual benefit, that produce benefits, that's hard work. It requires money. It requires a lot of work by the unions, but they are going forward.
Roland Green, let's talk about sort of root causes here. Clearly, campus officials and many folks in terms of public institutions talk about the movements to adjuncts as being driven by cost issues and funding issues confronting higher ed. But there are also those observers who say that in one sense the surplus of PhDs, particularly in the humanities, contributes to it. Is that a fair assessment, the fact that so many humanities PhDs are looking for are chasing employment, and the fact that this has been going on not just for years but in some cases for decades?
Well, I don't see that as a cause of this problem. I see it as a contributing condition to it. I think our position is that we need more tenure track jobs, not fewer, and that we are interested in creating the best learning conditions for our students, which tend to be the best working conditions for our faculty. And it's those kinds of better conditions are indispensable for universities on every level, from classroom instruction all the way through shared governance.
And Maria, what about the issue of, again, surplus of talent, as Roland says, a contributing factor that allows this to happen?
Well, I think that it's wrong to say that there's a surplus of talent or of PhDs. That there's an artificial reduction in the number of well-supported positions. And Roland is absolutely right. What should be driving these decisions is what's best for teaching and learning, what's best for students. And the only way forward, if you are interested in quality higher education, is addressing the appalling working conditions of contingent faculty and ending the practice of contingency.
Maria, it's hard to ignore the outsourcing metaphor that we saw in elsewhere in the American economy over the last two decades in the conversation about the situation of adjuncts. I mean, effectively, you could have at many campuses, particularly community colleges and some public four-year institutions, a course in English composition, in grammar, in widgets, if you will, that might be taught by full-time faculty, by part-time faculty, that might be taught online. Is the outsourcing metaphor fair?
Well, I think it's an accurate reflection of the managerial perspective that colleges and universities have adopted, and I think that they're discovering, I hope that they're discovering, how wrongheaded it has been and how counterproductive it's been, again, to the institutional mission. So the fact that there are efforts to reform both from within, we see that with the Delphi project on the changing faculty and student success, and efforts within disciplinary organizations, the actions of unions and organizations like ours, I think, is really indicative of the pushback against that model.
Scott Jasek at Inside Higher Ed, let me come back to something you said about public awareness, that beyond sort of the higher education community, Inside Higher Ed and other publications that were covering the run-up to February 25th, we saw articles elsewhere, and not just in the national media, if you will, New York Times and Wall Street Journal, but as you said, in a lot of local newspapers that also gave this a local slant, what's happening at the local college or the local community college. How broad was that, and how important is that?
I think it's important. I think you hear students even talking about this now. I had a student visitor to our office this week accompanying a visiting college president, and it was on the adjunct walkout day, and I asked her what she thought, and she said she preferred adjuncts to tenure track, and in fact, but preferred full-time adjuncts so that they could be there and interact more, but she said they were better teachers and more attentive to student needs. And so the reality is people are becoming aware that a lot of, not just a lot of teaching, but a lot of the best teaching comes from those off the tenure track. At the same time, I think it's important to note colleges are moving in both directions. There are unions, there are better conditions being offered at some campuses, but also in the last year we saw when the Obamacare regulations came out and many colleges were given the choice of they would have had to provide health insurance to their adjuncts working 30 hours a week. Many colleges responded by cutting their hours, not by giving health insurance. So colleges are making some decisions that are favorable to those off the tenure track. They're also continuing to make a lot of conditions that hurt those off the tenure track.
And Maria, how does the public awareness, again, not so much the national media, but in terms of local newspaper coverage and other kinds of local coverage for individual campuses, help your efforts, the efforts of adjunct faculty?
It's absolutely essential. And I think what it indicates is that adjunct faculty on the local level are feeling more empowered to speak out, to reach out to their local media, to communicate and to get their communities involved. And I think that that's going to be absolutely critical to moving forward, and we're absolutely thrilled to support people in those efforts.
Roland Green, let me come back to the outsourcing metaphor for a moment. What's the the relationship between adjunct, or as Maria says, contingency faculty and their full-time colleagues? Are they colleagues in one sense, or are they potentially competitors? How much does the campus climate affect that relationship?
Well, I can't speak to particular campuses, but I think what's constructive in this situation is the only thing that's constructive is for all of us to realize we are all colleagues, and that tenure line people depend on adjuncts and vice versa to foster a working learning community in the departments and the institutions where we teach. So we're focused at the MLA on creating the conditions that realize that sense of community, making the connections among people at different levels and enabling them to talk to each other, to organize together, to share perspectives. And the only thing that really works is for us to treat one another as a unified community, and we're committed to doing that.
And as you look forward a year from now, Maria, you know, what are the metrics that you and others at the new faculty majority and on individual campuses might use to say, you know what? What began as a kind of a random thought in an anonymous blog post actually created a national movement. A year from now, what will be the metrics you might use to say, yeah, we've begun something and we're seeing real benefits here?
Yeah. Well, again, I would dispute the notion that this is creating a movement. I think the movement has been in place for many, many years. This has been a really shining moment in the movement. But it's also been the result of a lot of work of a lot of people over many decades, a lot of organizations. And so I think it's going to keep propelling us forward. We're already planning events for the fall because this is a campus equity year. So I think we're going to just continue to see interest grow and activity increase, and I think we can only go forward. We've already reached the tipping point, so we are moving forward in a productive way, I think.
And Roland, at least from the perspective of the MLA, a year from now, given the MLA's initiatives that you discussed earlier, what are the metrics that you and your colleagues at the MLA, on behalf of part-time humanists who are working as adjuncts across the country, what metrics will you use to say, you know, something's moving here, we're seeing progress?
Well, to agree with Maria, we've crossed the threshold here, and we're not turning back. We are going to continue to monitor the numbers of people who are, in our particular initiative, the Action for Allies initiative, we're going to monitor the numbers of people that are going to sign on to generate those conversations and those action plans on their campuses, and we're going to keep developing the resources that we want to offer them that enable them to stay connected to each other. So we are imagining thousands of conversations going on all over the country in all kinds of departments about what can be done, and we're very encouraged to imagine those conversations and to play a part in making them happen.
And Scott Jasek, as the journalist in this conversation, when we have this conversation a year from now in 2016 for the second annual Day Without Adjuncts, if such a thing happens, what metrics will you be looking for in terms of what's happened over the last 12 months as saying this has moved forward, we're seeing progress in terms of the concerns articulated by the adjunct community?
I'll be looking to see, are adjuncts getting better pay, better job security, better benefits. We reported a few months ago Tufts University part-time faculty won a contract with a union that guarantees them by September 2016 $7,300 a course. Now, Tufts is wealthier than many institutions that have adjuncts, but I'll be asking, are we seeing meaningful gains in wages? Are we seeing meaningful gains in job security? Are we seeing health insurance? A lot of what adjuncts are asking for are very practical, bread and butter issues, and we want to know if this actually happens. And I think that's something we'll be tracking.
Great. Maria Maisto, Roland Green, Scott Jasek, thank you for the insight you've brought to the conversation about what happened on February 25th and what happens going forward after the Day Without Adjuncts. In our second segment today, we talk about the AP History Exam in Oklahoma. Political concerns about the tone, tenor, and topics covered by the College Board's framework for the new Advanced Placement U.S. History Exam have moved from campus to capital in many states. Last summer, the Republican National Committee endorsed a resolution asking state legislators to investigate the new AP history exam and encouraging Congress to withhold federal funding to the College Board until the exam is rewritten and recognizes the sovereignty of state standards. The Washington Post reports that elected officials in six states, Colorado, Oklahoma, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Texas, have publicly criticized the guidelines. Criticism about the new AP history test comes from conservatives who characterize the new curriculum as light on key, some might argue traditional or old school aspects of American history, and also too negative on some aspects of the American experience and the experiences of some groups of Americans. Joining us for this conversation are Jim Grossman, the Executive Director of the American Historical Association, and Scott Jasek, co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. So Jim Grossman at the American Historical Association, let me begin with you. What's the real issue here with the AP exam? Just how political is this in Oklahoma, and you know what's going on in some of the other states?
Well, the real issue here is whether we're going to be teaching high school students how to think historically, how to look at the history of the United States in a way that helps them to think historically, to think critically, or whether we're going to straightforwardly teach them patriotism. And actually, the real issue is the definition of patriotism. And there are many of us, historians and otherwise, who believe that teaching students patriotism is teaching them how to be good citizens, which is how to think critically and thoughtfully and informatively about the history of the nation.
But this is not the first time that U.S. history has gotten political. I recall that during her tenure at the National Endowment for the Humanities, Mrs. Cheney, the former vice president's wife, got into arguments with many in higher education about certain aspects of the history curriculum. How different is the new exam compared to the old exam that would lead to this action in a number of states?
Well, the new exam offers a framework that is more diverse, but most important, that emphasizes historical thinking. It's not as directive. It doesn't say, here are the subjects to teach, and here's how you teach them. It very much is, here's how you help students think in these ways that historians think. And one of the things to remember here that's absolutely crucial is the AP exam is not an entry-level high school course. The AP exam is the culminating examination of a college course. High school teachers are teaching a first year college course. And what the College Board has done with this new framework, it's not a curriculum, it's a framework, is try to help high school teachers think of themselves as college and university teachers and think of the course as a college and university course.
Scott Jasek from Inside Higher Ed, Jim's given us some map of the landscape. What can you add to this in terms of the arguments and counterarguments about the new exam?
Well, I think the arguments about allegedly dropping key points in American history are largely irrelevant, actually. People who are taking AP history with new guidelines are going to learn about the Founding Fathers. They're going to learn about the Civil War. They're going to learn about the World Wars. I don't think it's possible that there are very many courses that aren't going to cover these pivotal moments in American history. And if you look at the example test questions that the College Board has released, they reflect these points. I think, one, there is a resistance to anything that presents any element of American history in a non-triumphal way. And certainly part of thinking like a historian, as Jim was talking about, is being critical, even if you love your country. And there's also a lot of nervousness about anything that is a national educational standard. Among the conservative movement today, people don't like anything that's national. And AP, because it is in fact taught in high schools all over the country, is national.
But Jim, let me come back to one of your comments. You described the test as being less directive. I mean, this is kind of an interesting shift in terms of the experience that we've seen in terms of response to No Child Left Behind and teaching to the test. You seem to suggest that, in fact, there's less opportunity to teach to the test, more flexibility potentially for individual instructors and curriculum providers to define the course material. Is that also true?
I think that's absolutely right. I think some of what's going on here is a matter of how much we trust our high school AP teachers to teach a good course. Scott is right on the ball here when he says there's lots of space in here for teachers to put all of these things that various people think are important into the course. And the exam itself actually starts with Benjamin Franklin and the evangelist George Whitefield. This is religion. This is an iconic figure. Anybody who is concerned about whether something they think is important, like George Washington, Martin Luther King, or whatever, is in the course, all they have to do is Google APUSH, APUSH, and their favorite topic or person. And they will find the actual work that teachers and students have on the web from these courses. And they'll see that Scott is 100% correct about this.
So we're now at the end of February. High school classes begin in September. There's roughly 6 months or so for teachers to begin preparing for the new curricula and the new standards. How is this playing out in the six states where there has been opposition and in other states, Jim?
I don't know how it's playing out in each of those states. I mean, I hear when there's a problem, basically. And so this popped up originally because of the Republican National Committee opposition. It's now popped up in Oklahoma. I know that there have been objections in Texas. There have been objections in Georgia. As far as I know, Oklahoma is the first state to put legislation on the table. And you'll notice, by the way, that the freshman legislator who put that legislation on the table has taken it off the table. He realizes that there were some problems with the way he framed it.
But in Oklahoma, it was certainly framed in very dire ways. Scott, what are you hearing about what's going on in other states in terms of legislative or other activity at the state level, state boards of education?
Well, I mean, this comes up. This is a political maneuver that you see in a number of states, and it's not just about American history. I mean, when these legislators look at AP biology, they will find out, for instance, that evolution exists and, in fact, is the basis for some of what students learn in biology. There is a discomfort in some circles with scholarship and with the ways students are taught to think today. And AP is a very convenient punching bag. I actually think the broader problem isn't that AP is going to fall apart. AP, in fact, has been gaining in popularity. Students want AP. Parents want AP. I think it's a diversion of attention. When you look at the problems American high schools face in preparing students for college, the AP program is not the problem. And this is a diversion from issues that really do need attention.
So part of this seems to be about state control. The long history of American education is that, in fact, the states decide what goes on in the individual states. We don't have a federal curriculum, although, again, I think, Scott, you mentioned earlier, you know, that the College Board serves as kind of a proxy for that. But I want to come back to Jim's point. This is not a high school course. This is a college course that students are taking while in high school. The Republican National Committee references state standards. The AP exam never has really been about state standards, and yet we see this as a state-level issue. You know, what seems to be the elephant in the room is this the proxy battle for Common Core in many instances? That anger about Common Core is now being reflected in terms of some of the issues with the AP exam. Jim?
The issue of state control in some ways is very similar to the issue of states' rights. In other words, it's a principle invoked when you need to invoke it, as opposed to a principle that's there all the time. I have not yet heard of any concern expressed over any kind of AP national curriculum in chemistry, mathematics, physics, of a wide variety of subjects that are less controversial. This is going to pop up in history. This is going to pop up in biology. So the notion that somehow the main issue is where the locus of control lies is a bit of a red herring. Nobody seems concerned about about any kind of national AP curriculum in chemistry. So this does come down to, in many ways, the issues that Scott referenced earlier, because history, biology, these are disciplines that have hot button elements to them.
I'm reminded of Senator Pat Patrick Moynihan's quip that you, sir, are entitled to your own opinions but not your own facts, that some of this seems to be playing out in these areas in terms of biology, where we've seen this in textbook issues in a number of states and high schools, the history exam. What other areas, Scott, might be potentially vulnerable to this kind of controversy?
Well, certainly some conservative critics like to look at reading lists and literature courses, and you have some of the same issue where they do Google searches and say, oh my gosh, no one's forced to study Shakespeare, when in fact Shakespeare is alive and well in our literature classrooms in the country. I think the other key thing, though, to go back to the previous point about state policy is, it's definitely true many states have stepped up their encouragement of high school districts offering AP courses. It's important to remember AP isn't generally required of any student. In most cases, high schools are choosing to offer it. Students are choosing to enroll, and they're choosing to enroll in part because they perceive it as helping them get into college. But nobody is lining up American students and forcing them into AP courses. So it is a national curriculum only in that it's being offered all over the place, but it's not in fact being imposed on most American students.
Not only that, but if you look what happened in Colorado, I think what Scott has just said is extremely important. The students who were demonstrating, who walked out of school demonstrating in Colorado in favor of the AP exam, in favor of the AP framework course, were actually demonstrating in favor of a course that was much harder than the one that the school board wanted their teachers to teach. So part of what we're seeing, what we saw in Colorado, was the wonderful experience of students walking out of school and demonstrating in order for the right to take a harder course.
Gentlemen, 6 months, calendar again, thinking about fall 2015 when classes open and students begin these AP history courses and potentially in some other areas. Jim, what's your prediction? Is this going to essentially just be part of the political skirmishing, a lot of smoke but not much heat, or in fact will there be some consequences in individual states?
I'm a historian. I try to understand and explain what's already happened rather than predict what's going to happen.
Best guess, Jim.
I'll be honest with you. I don't have a best guess. I think this is playing out in interesting ways in different places. And quite frankly, again, as a historian and as a humanist, I think it's a very good thing for Americans to argue over, how we think about our history, how we think about the past, and what we teach our children in our schools. This is part of the AP framework, is in fact an emphasis on debate, an emphasis on difference of opinion. This is how I define good citizenship and patriotism, is this kind of healthy debate.
And Scott, best guess as we approach the beginning of this, you know, the preparation for the beginning of the school year in fall 2015?
My guess is that AP U.S. History under the new framework will be offered and students will be taking it, that the citizens of Tulsa won't be walking around dismayed over it, but that it will continue to be a punching bag, that you might see some cuts in state spending to help the AP program, and that you'll hear people criticize AP, Common Core, anything that is seen as national. You're going to hear a lot of criticism of it as the Republican primaries get underway.
Great. Thank you, Jim Grossman from the American Historical Association, for joining us this week to discuss the new politics of the AP History Exam. Thanks as well to Scott Jasek from Inside Higher Ed. Also, we want to thank Roland Green from Stanford University and the Modern Language Association, and Maria Maisto from the new faculty majority for the conversation in the first segment about the Day Without Adjuncts. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio streamer podcast early afternoon on most Fridays. On the web, we are available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. This Week is also available on iTunes. Please share your thoughts about This Week with us on the comments section of the webpage. Thank you.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.